Good morning. Today, groups throughout Hawaii are condemning President Trump's executive orders on immigration and travel restrictions. They say the executive orders are a direct attack on commitments to treat people equally under the law, regardless of creed, color, background, or birthplace. We'll talk with one of the organizers, immigration attorney Claire Hanyus. And around the country, a Hawaii bill to consider homelessness as a health condition is getting a lot of attention. Senator Josh Green joins us to talk about why. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Jason and the Argonauts set off in search of the Golden Fleece thousands of years ago, and they're still looking. John Watt is the director of a modern-day version called Argonautica. And high school students from across the islands will soon compete in the statewide finals of Poetry Out Loud, a national recitation contest. Vivian Lee of the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts looks ahead.
That's the conversation for this Wednesday, February 1st. Now news. Welcome to the conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Immigration has special relevance in Hawaii because, for any number of reasons, yeah?
Because we all came here from someplace else.
But that being one of them, yes.
And many people would say that about the United States in general, but
they better say that about the United States.
Yeah, and we've seen how that's taken on a completely different meaning in very, very recent days. Now, outrage heard across the nation over President Trump's executive order on immigration affecting seven majority Muslim countries includes Hawaii. Later today, many groups, including the Muslim Association of Hawaii, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the Interfaith Alliance Hawaii, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Hawaii, will be issuing a joint response to the executive order. Beyond the positioning of opposition, we wanted to get a clearer picture of immigration in Hawaii. We called immigration attorney Claire Hanyus, who's in our studio this morning. Thank you for coming in.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
On the face of it, just hearing about the executive order was enough to get a lot of people to turn up to the airport in Honolulu over the weekend and to chant and to be there to, you know, welcome people and say, you know, this isn't us, in effect. But really, truly, what does immigration look like in Hawaii? Are we haven't really been a destination point for a lot of refugees. Maybe people choosing to move here through other means, but from refugee status, what are we looking at in
Hawaii? Well, looking back at what the executive order that was issued late Friday night, it has a curious title, Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. And it effectively barred all refugee admissions for 120 days, barred all Syrian admissions indefinitely, and barred admissions from nationals of seven countries for at least a 90-day period. And so it was issued late Friday night. There were immediate challenges and demonstrations that took place on Saturday. And in cities where populations of those, especially the seven affected countries, were much larger. Now, as you said, in Hawaii, we don't have a lot of refugee resettlement happening here, although there is some. There are a number of local nonprofit organizations that do refugee resettlement, and there are a number of families that were scheduled to come here who were in the pipeline who have been held up.
And Claire, are we talking about handfuls of people here?
We're talking
or more.
Well, I mean, as far as people lives directly impacted by this ban, we're talking about handfuls.
But when we start to talk about universities and faculty and students who are foreign-born,
sure,
that begins to look like a bigger picture.
That does begin to look like a larger picture because it's basically many people in our state who are dual nationals, Iranian and the U.S. I know a number at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. There are questions about green card holders and impacts on them, and then there's larger questions that people have and larger fears from people from the countries that aren't directly enumerated in this order, who are just concerned about traveling and being stuck outside of outside of the United States.
Yeah, another, the idea that you can go, but you can't come back.
Sure, sure. Or you might not want to, or you might not be able to come back. And people are really, really obviously fearful of that. There have also been reports that United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is kind of the benefit end of the Department of Homeland Security, is holding up green card adjustment of status cases for people in the United States from those seven countries. And so you would normally say in Hawaii, if a U.S. citizen marries a foreign national, it takes about 3 months generally start to finish to get a green card. Now for people from those seven countries, they are being interviewed as scheduled, but then the cases are being held indefinitely. So, and we don't know how many people that might involve in our community. Individual attorneys who have them, who have those cases would know, of course, but, you know, many people, because attorneys are often expensive or out of reach of people, they do it themselves. And then these aren't the groups of people that would be comfortable speaking out about what's happening to them. Their number one concern is, you know, protecting and guarding their family. And there's, of course, a huge fear of backlash for people who come forward. We've heard reports from the Muslim community of an increase in hate. I don't know if it would rise to hate crimes, but definitely intimidation in local Muslims. And so I think the president's actions really have emboldened people who are afraid of the other. And some of those people we know have dangerous and violent tendencies, and these are homegrown, right? These aren't people from the seven affected countries.
So later today, when these 21 organizations, including several you belong to, come together to issue a joint statement, that statement will be regarded as it is. But what happens afterward? What are you planning to do afterward in Hawaii to connect what's going on in Hawaii, which is not a lot in the way that other states may be looking at refugee resettlement, to not only just engage Hawaii, but to make Hawaii part of the conversation? Right. What happens after today?
Well, we're continuing to monitor Customs and Border Protection and international arrivals at the airport. And working through the congressional offices so that if there are reports, we can have attorneys on hand to provide assistance to those people. We're also getting the word out to the community, again, that if people do have family members who may be trapped outside of the United States, we'd like those people to come forward to attorneys. And there are legal challenges all over the United States to this. We could mount a similar case in Hawaii.
You're talking lawsuits here.
Lawsuits, exactly. And there are templates. I mean, attorneys, you know, nationwide have really done a beautiful job coming forward and banding together and sharing information. So we wouldn't have to recreate the wheel. There are templates available that we could take into federal court immediately. And then also just, again, to monitor what's happening on the national level and get the word back to the local community and try to dispel any myths and advise people as we can as far as what their risks of travel are.
You mentioned that there have been, if not threats, but certainly intimidation within the Muslim community and other communities that might feel it in some way. For a lot of people, thinking about Hawaii in those terms is really difficult. I mean, we have this idea of ourselves as being warm and welcoming and, you know, aloha for all. But that's clearly not what we're seeing. And as you also say that, you know, these are homegrown people. These are not people who have come to Hawaii who are doing some of these things. How then do you begin to stem that, not just what's happening with national policy, perhaps, but what's happening in Hawaii with the way perhaps we are changing?
Right. Well, I think, you know, as the nation is quite polarized right now, I think Hawaii is polarized to some degree as well. We don't have the kind of redneck yahoos showing up as happened in demonstrations, say in Arizona or some other states. But I think there are people still who are very fearful of the other and things who are different, who voice opposition in other ways. And when we we like to think of ourselves as all embracing and welcoming. But if you look at the comment section in the newspaper after an article, say, about the protest at the airport, or if there's anything that's ever pro-immigrant in the newspaper, there are always nasty comments following about really kind of knee-jerky, we need to keep ourselves safe. These people are potentially dangerous and causing harm to us, where there's absolutely no evidence
so
of that.
So how do you look at that as being something that could be worked on in Hawaii to change some of those ideas or to be able to broaden knowledge or perspective?
Yeah, I think that's where this conversation and just engaging. Maybe we've talked to some organizations about trying to put the face of the refugee in our community and the success stories. Refugees often do phenomenally well economically once they get settled because they are so motivated. They've given up so much, and many of them are highly educated in their own countries. They just can't live there anymore, and they come to the United States and they add to the fabric of our society, and many success stories. And so maybe trying to get those stories out so much so that refugees aren't seen as people who are here to either do harm or take from us, but people who are here to give and contribute as well. And it's the fact that the refugee ban affects refugees from all countries around the world. It's not just Middle Eastern or Muslim countries. We really need to think about what that means and what that says about us as a nation by not being willing to open our doors to people who we have promised safe haven to, whose lives are now thrown into limbo.
Claire Hannis, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thanks for the chance.
We'll hear more this afternoon. Claire Hannis is an immigration attorney at Damon Key, Leong Kupchak Hastert in Honolulu. She's also past Hawaii chapter chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and is also a founding member of the Hawaii Coalition for Immigration Reform. She says she stands firmly opposed to President Trump's executive order blocking entry of refugees and travelers from 7 predominantly Muslim countries, because she says they are unconstitutional, illegal, and cruel.
Ralph Ellison's classic Invisible Man has a comedic, mind-bending sequel in Paul Beatty's The Sellout.
These institutions are supposed to be reflective of American culture, however you see that.
In Beatty's America, what was invisible about the rise of Trump has been plain as day for those who dared to look. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, setting out in search of the Golden Fleece. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a now forgotten holiday, one that represents a milestone in Hawaii history. It was the day that connected Hawaii to the wider world. That day was Cable Day, and it was celebrated with a message from the President of the United States, a 100-gun salute, and the debut performance of a song called The Pacific Cable March, composed by Royal Hawaiian Band director Henry Berger. Honolulu merchants were asked to shut their doors at midday to join the celebration, and local newspapers were filled with headlines about the happy event. The occasion was the completion of a trans-Pacific telegraph cable that linked the newly established territory of Hawaii to the U.S. mainland. The president's congratulatory message was relayed to Hawaii just after New Year's Day, and our backyard quiz today asks you for the year of this pivotal event. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get the right answer gets the prize.
It's one of the most enduring stories from Greek mythology, the story of Jason and the crew of the Argo, his Argonauts, and their quest for the Golden Fleece. It has all the elements of a classic story: a hero, a heroic quest, an epic voyage to overcome any number of obstacles, plenty of intervention from the gods, who are as much prey to human frailties as regular humans are. John Watt is directing a modern-day adaptation called Argonautica, the Mid-Pacific School of the Arts, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Chris.
This is, at first blush, a story of manly men and their manly deeds, right?
Absolutely. It's the first voyage across the open ocean of the Greeks, and it's full of testosterone. You know, Hercules is one of the great characters. He's all muscle and not too much brain. But on the other hand, this version by Mary Zimmerman also kind of gives a feminist twist. I was talking to my actors, my student actors, the other day, and I said, look at all the testosterone in this play, but yet somehow, who drives it? And it turns out it's Hera and Athena and Aphrodite and Medea. It's all the women who actually drive the action of the play. So it's kind of exciting to see that kind of take on it.
There's a lesson in there somewhere, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, how does that play out in terms of how the action is seen on the stage?
Well, it's a fantastic production. It's full of stuff. We have a, you know, kind of huge setting of a ship's deck with lots of rigging, and we have all kinds of prop. The prop list is beyond belief. We have like big bull's heads and a dragon, and we're trying something new at Mid-Pacific this year. We're actually flying one of our actors up on a cable from the grid, which is kind of exciting. Not as exciting as perhaps Peter Pan, but there's lots going on. You know,
exciting
skeleton
enough
warriors
for the actor.
Oh, I'm yeah, sure. Absolutely. And, you know, it's an epic story. So there's, in a small space, you know, we have to negotiate where to put the oars and all kinds of other fun things for the actors, but also, I think, exciting for the spectators as well.
So many epic stories, and I'm thinking of, obviously, of Joseph Campbell here, involve a quest.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the hero's journey, the look for something that gives us, as human beings, kind of a sense of who we are and meaning, and our ability to make our way into the world is always kind of exciting.
Yeah, what does the Golden Fleece, you know, what does he want from the Golden Fleece? Is it simply riches?
You know, that's interesting. I think originally, the way this story plays out, he has no idea about the Golden Fleece, except that his father has lost the kingdom to his bad uncle, and he goes to visit the bad uncle, and the bad uncle sends him to find the Golden Fleece just because he thinks, if I send Jason out to get the Golden Fleece, he'll get killed, and he won't bother me about the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And then Jason takes on this quest, and it becomes about really the great adventure for all the men, the ability to do something that nobody else has ever done before.
Yeah.
So I think that's really what the quest is all about.
And that's kind of where its universality
absolutely
comes from,
yeah,
as well. You know, but the whole idea of the things that motivate heroes and gods often come down to somewhat simple, even petty,
yeah, absolutely,
human motivations, right?
And the Greeks are wonderful about that too, because their gods are just like human beings, only more so.
Yeah,
so.
They get jealous.
Yes, absolutely.
They get irrational.
Yes. There's a wonderful scene at the beginning of the first act where Hera and Athena decide that Aphrodite can help them, and they go to visit her. And when the scene opens, of course, Aphrodite's looking in a mirror, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with this.
she's doing her makeup.
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, very much like what we think of some stereotypical people that we know.
But it also it also goes against this sort of they don't automatically bond together as sisters. There's some jealousies and rivalries.
Oh, absolutely. Aphrodite, Hera and Athena are bonded in some ways, although they have major disagreements as well. Uh-huh. Athena, of course, is all about reason, and Hera is much more the kind of motherly, sympathetic character. She likes to help people out. But at the same time, Athena is the one who really kind of forces the action, whereas Hera finds a guy like Hercules to be, as dumb as a baked potato, I think she says.
That's sort of, poor old Hercules gets a little bit deglamorized in this story.
Oh, he absolutely does. And I have a wonderful young man playing him. I saw him last spring. And I said, I think I have a part for you. And he said, oh, what is that? I said, it's Hercules. And he went, And I said, big body, not too bright. And the young man said, I think I can handle that.
Well, that's good that he embraced that whole notion. But, for an actor, it can be fun to play somebody who's not too bright, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the young man who is playing it, is a full IB student. He's a quite bright young man. So the ability to play that kind of character requires some kind of intelligence as well.
Well, it's not easy to play somebody who's not too bright. It's not easy to play somebody who's extremely intelligent.
Yes, absolutely.
People tend to think that if you furrow your brow, you're intelligent, and that you've met that goal. But the idea and your whole task is to get your actors to sort of get to that kind of essence, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we're very lucky to have very talented and highly trained students, and we have a long tradition of doing really great work. So our actors have very high expectations for their own work that they do on these projects. And they learn a lot, too. I mean, when we work on a project like this, they learn a lot about Greek culture. They learn a lot about psychology. They learn a lot about what it is to be a human being. And, of course, they work very hard together, so they have to learn about collaboration. And, I think Mary Zimmerman often says that a lot of her plays are about love, centrally, and relationships, and our students get to look at that as well.
Well, it really sounds like a fresh take on a story we thought we knew, right, John?
Absolutely, and I'm excited to be working on it.
Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
John Watt is the director of Argonautica by Mary Zimmerman, a theatrical retelling of the Greek myth of the voyage of Jason and the Argonauts. It runs on weekends from February 3rd to the 12th at Mid-Pacific Institute's Kauai Hau Recital Hall.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
What does the public in Hawaii Public Radio mean? It means we're available to everyone and free of commercial influences. It means reporting to help you be a more informed decision maker, whether it's political hearings of national importance, in-depth coverage of events here and abroad, interviews that provide insight and context. Your financial support puts all of that on the air. If you're already an HPR member, mahalo. If you're yet to contribute to make this important public service possible, please go to our website today, and thank you.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard says her trip to Syria and who paid for it has become, in her words, a distraction. But for those questioning her secret trip, the organization and its backers are key facts. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
In talking to her, was there a sense that she was trying to obfuscate some of this information?
Obfuscate. That's a good use of a word that in itself implies so much. We didn't speak with her so much as we relied on emails from her office, directly from her and from her staff. I do think she is sincere in wanting to move on. This has made a lot of headlines, most of them critical, particularly about her meeting with the president of Syria, Assad. That's raised concerns in some circles. Others, by the way, are applauding her, saying she's doing something brave and trying to question U.S. policy in the area. But I think Gabbard's main point is that that point is getting lost, that we shouldn't be advocating for regime change. We shouldn't be supporting the Syrian rebels. We ought to be focused on peace. Instead, everybody is focused on who paid for the trip, why did you go, who arranged to meet Assad, and these things have really taken over the headlines.
And a point that we've talked about before, why do this alone, and why do it on the day, or you know, not be there on the
week,
day that,
yeah.
Or the week that the president's being inaugurated? It seemed to want to, in some ways, to shift the conversation. Maybe that's a good thing for some people. Maybe some people still find that questionable. But is this a case of real knowledge seeking, or is it, as some have suggested, political grandstanding?
Well, there are certainly those that have suggested political grandstanding. But let's face it, Tulsi Gabbard is no stranger to being able to grab the spotlight. She's a frequent commentator on TV and any number of things. She did, however, point to Denis Kucinich going along with her on the trip. Remember, he's the former Ohio representative, a former presidential candidate. And we did speak to Denis Kucinich and emailed back and forth. And he said, look, the people that set up this trip are good people. They're advocates for peace. This is really being blown out of proportion. Gabbard herself called claims that the group that she met with is pro-Assad, or specifically she said these media claims about her, these critics, are baseless. And Kucinich said essentially the same. So I think both sides of the story are being heard, but still it was enough to force her to come to the conclusion that she should pay for the trip. By the way, we don't know how much money that is. That will be disclosed at some point, but neither her nor Bassam Kawam, who we also spoke with, he's the guy in Ohio that helped set up the trip, he wouldn't tell us how much either went to pay for the trip.
And nothing from the group Access either in Hawaii? Ohio?
It actually appears to be a real group. Kucinich sent photos taken Monday of the offices, and we spoke to Kawam in Cleveland where the offices are, and he says, yes, it's real. Others say it hasn't really been around for a while. Excuse me, let me clarify that. Others say that it's really just sort of an empty shell. In fact, we checked its tax returns, and it hasn't had any assets or revenue since 2007. So if it is an active organization, it's doing it without any money that's reported to the IRS. So some question as to how legitimate it is, but Kucinich did stand up for it.
And just finally, looking at the Civil Beat site this morning and the editorial that you've put out saying that Gabbard crossed the line with a secret trip to Syria. Why?
I'll have to defer that to the editors. That's their call. I'm not involved with the writing of the editorials, but it did rely on a lot of the reporting, particularly Josh Rogan of the Washington Post. There's reports in The Guardian, reports in The Atlantic about the trip. So I'd have to ask readers to make that judgment on their own. It simply wasn't my story, and I'm just a peon here, just a reporter.
All right, but as you brought up the Rogan story where he called the congresswoman a mouthpiece for the organization,
yes,
and for Assad, whether she realizes it or not, his words. All right. Well, we're going to see how this continues to play out and no doubt talk about it at least one more time.
Thanks
very
Beth
much,
Ann.
Chad. Talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and he joins us every day with a reality check. Around the country, a Hawaii state senator has made news for a simple assertion. Homelessness is a medical condition. Senator and Dr. Josh Green says other approaches to homelessness have failed and that addressing homelessness as a health condition makes medical sense and would save the state money. He's introduced a bill to allow treatment of homelessness to be covered under health insurance plans. SB2 was deferred in committees this week until February 6th. Senator Green is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Honored to be with you.
According to the World Health Organization, the determinants of health are about whether people are healthy or not. That's determined by their circumstances and their environment. That seems to speak directly to the issue of homelessness. As you look at it through that lens of determinants of health, how do you describe homelessness?
Well, I now describe it as a medical condition directly, Beth Ann. We've been dancing around the issue for decades, and I'm so gratified that the major institutions across the world really have continuously enhanced their descriptions with social determinants of health, like whether you're in poverty, whether your educational, your educational experiences have held you back, and so on. But we haven't really moved the needle on homelessness. So now I want it to be considered a medical condition. I'll unpack that for you. But let me be really clear with people who think it might be an idea ahead of its time. We already devote an incredible amount of resources to those who are struggling, who are homeless. All of these individuals, all of them, especially the chronically homeless, have very, very complex health conditions, mental illness, drug addiction, and any number of chronic diseases.
Right. And we talk about those, but we tend to talk about them separate from the overall idea that homelessness is, in effect, itself a medical condition. So to reframe it in that way and to unpack some of this a little bit, as you suggest,
yes.
How do we look at that in totality, given the idea that if someone is considered healthy, you have to take into consideration not only their physical being, but where that physical being is, their environment?
Yes. Well, let's start from the beginning. So what is a health condition? A health condition is something that affects our mind or our body adversely. Of course, we could spend hours and hours discussing that definition, but that's what we basically look at as health conditions as doctors, which I am. And what is treatment? A treatment is a solution or a remedy or an intervention that can help deal with a health condition, sometimes modified if it's a chronic disease, sometimes cured if it's an acute disease. So in this particular case, we have this problem, homelessness. It affects every individual who is homeless and their families very significantly. It costs them dearly because they suffer. It costs society dearly. It even becomes an illness for society because we spend so much resource and get so little improvement in people's lives. So when you look at it in this new way, as a medical condition, you open up other opportunities to treat the condition. When you treat the condition, you actually get people off the streets. You get them into shelter. You get a house over there, a roof over their heads. So you actually have a treatment. And the important thing, the very important thing is, as you treat this condition itself, you're also treating all the other challenges that come with it. When people are unsheltered, it's very, very, very threatening to their mental state. They develop acute psychosis. They are threatened with additional drug addiction. Many, many individuals are sexually assaulted when they're homeless. It's so complex a health problem that we need to bring new resources to it.
And the irony is, forgive me, I'm
going to turn it right back to you, Beth Ann.
Okay.
The irony is we already have those resources available. We just haven't been spending them right.
I want to get to that in a second, but the idea of getting a roof over somebody's head most immediately, get them stabilized by making sure that they are in a safe place, seemed to be the idea of housing first that we spent a lot of time talking about, in particular over the last 2 years. That seems to fall a little bit short, though, of what you are suggesting. How, then, do we look at that with not just getting a roof over someone's head and then wrapping services around them after they're stabilized?
Brilliant question. Okay, so first of all, Housing First is a great program. It's a terrific program. It's just coming up way too short because even in the current governor's budget, and I have incredible respect for the governor and the governor's team on homelessness because they're fighting so hard to work on this problem, they still only come up with an ask of $3 million, which will only take care of 10% of the chronically homeless. I'm even having a hearing today. So because it's so difficult to find significant or adequate resources for the chronically homeless, we have to look at the problem from other perspectives. Enter this solution. The state of Hawaii spends $2 billion every year. One out of every seven of our listeners' dollars is going to Medicaid. One out of seven. $2 billion. Most of that money goes to a very small number of individuals who are suffering with lots and lots of illness or challenges. We spend that money very poorly, and it's a gigantic amount of resource that, if repurposed, because this is a health condition, a medical condition, we could use a very small portion of those Medicaid dollars, as long as we get the approvals, and solve this problem by funding essentially Housing First. Housing First, using Medicaid dollars, would be essentially the treatment, the prescription.
Medicaid, though, is coming under fire in Washington. The idea that Medicaid may not be the Medicaid that we know, or Medicare for that matter either, that both may be now, you know, translated into block grants. What happens then?
Well, let me share a little secret with you. I'm trying to set a trap, and I don't mean it negatively, but for the Trump administration. If the Trump administration does two of the following things: one, they go down the road, like you say, of block grants, and two, they invoke their usual ideology, which is states' rights prevail, then if we are in that circumstance, with block grants and state rights prevailing, I contend that that is our opportunity to say, okay, let us have autonomy over our Medicaid budget. Because one very important point that we haven't yet touched on is, when you put that roof over someone's head, their health care costs drop 43%. That's a Hawaii-based study. So if we have that opportunity to choose our own road with our Medicaid dollars in this block grant idea, which I don't normally agree with, if that happens, we will have the opportunity of all opportunities to get ahead of our homelessness crisis, this medical problem in our state, and actually solve it. And the best part is, my most conservative calculations, most conservative, if we spent $30 million on Medicaid, of Medicaid dollars on Housing First for homeless solutions, we will immediately save $67 million of not wasting that money when people go to the ER repeatedly, when people use the medics unnecessarily. So we both use the money we're already spending, but we use it better. So we could just see an alliance between our fiscal conservative neighbors and our social justice friends, because this actually is a solution that's already paid for.
So what are you hearing from both of those sectors?
Well, everybody, you know, is taken aback, because interestingly, this hasn't been proposed. As you said earlier, I'm getting calls from all across the nation asking if they could do it, including the people in Los Angeles. You know, California has 112,000 individuals that are chronically homeless. 118,000, I'm sorry. I think that this idea's time is going to come sooner than we expect. I think that once people like the Chamber, who I have a great deal of respect for, see that it will decrease costs in Medicaid, they will be very, very interested. When our small businesses realize that their hard-earned tax dollars will get paid and used better, I think they also will be in favor of it. And I'll tell you, I'm getting obviously a lot of positive affirmation from people who feel that this is a social justice issue and we should have long ago fully funded Housing First.
Well, we got to go in just a second, but I wanted to ask you, is this now something that's, as you say, you're getting so much attention from around the country, and all you have to do is Google that to see the pages and pages of different stories that have been reported on this. Is this something that you can build into a coalition of states?
It is, and I intend to speak nationally about this. I intend to travel widely if people want to hear about our experience. And I hope that Hawaii, if it can't do it fully and immediately, will at least begin to pilot the process with our insurers, so that we can prove to the world that this is both a good investment and the right thing to do.
All right. Well, we'll be watching this carefully, and thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Again, I'm so appreciative.
Senator Josh Green is the introducer of a bill that would make homelessness a medical condition.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa.
Mom.
And Bert, UH is equipped with supercomputers, but what kind of things can be done on a supercomputer?
You know, Chris, ever since I was working at the Maui supercomputer, and this was back in a decade that was prior to 2000, which was a long time ago. I've always wanted to talk a little bit more about what is the capability of high-performance computing and supercomputing and these big, you know, parallel processors.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we never got to get anybody really on the show because the, you know, the Maui supercomputer is a DoD facility, and
right.
they're kind of reluctant about talking about it. So, but we're in a new age, and in 2017, the University of Hawaii has their own. They have their own supercomputer, and we have the pleasure of talking to a couple of researchers that are actually using using the computer. In fact, the computer's used quite a bit with pretty specific kinds of applications. So what we want to do is we want to talk about what are those applications, what are the unique features of this supercomputer, and what are some of the problems or challenges that they'd actually try to solve.
Bert, what's an example of a problem you might need a supercomputer
well,
to
I think,
address?
Most of the conditions or the specifications for a project would be that it has a lot of data. I mean, it could be something with the cosmos. It could be something like genomics. There's a lot of data, and you want to do some data analysis. And what the supercomputer does is it does a lot of number crunching very quickly.
So when we get the cosmos figured out, we'll be hearing about it on your show, I don't
know. Oh, most certainly.
That's what I figured. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m. In today's Backyard Quiz, Hawaii was changed forever when, on December 28, 1902, the cable ship Silverton linked an undersea telegraph cable from Sanssouci Beach at Waikiki to San Francisco. For the first time, Hawaii newspapers were able to report same-day dispatches from around the world. The official celebration came a few days after the cable was laid, marked by a 100-gun salute, a message of congratulations from President Theodore Roosevelt, and a performance by the Royal Hawaiian Band. Henry Berger, the bandmaster, had written the Pacific Cable March and dedicated its performance to John McKay, the president of the Commercial Pacific Company, which completed the Pacific Cable project. The cable remained a primary communications link to the Hawaiian Islands until 1951, and it all started on Cable Day, January 2nd, 1903. And 1903 is the year we were looking for. Nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Poetry recitation was once a standard element of secondary school education. Students were called upon to memorize and be ready to perform great poems, Shakespearean soliloquies, and historic speeches like Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. It's dismissed by some as rote learning, but it brought generations into contact with great language and the ideas that inform it. The practice is being kept alive by a national initiative called Poetry Out Loud. Hawaii statewide finals are coming up, and Vivian Lee, Arts Program Specialist with the Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts, is on hand to look ahead to them. Good morning, Vivian.
Good morning, Chris.
This is kind of an exciting event, just seeing what kids do in this recitation contest.
You wouldn't think that reciting poetry is exciting, necessarily, but the finals are so exciting. It's to see those students up there that have really, it takes courage.
It takes
courage to stand up there. They have to stand in a little square of 2 feet by 2 feet and recite this poem out to the audience. And as an audience member, it's exciting, it's moving, and it's competitive. You know, you really see how the interpretation of the poem is changed by the person who delivers it.
Sure.
And so you know, you wouldn't necessarily think that this is a – it's not like football or basketball finals.
Yeah.
But it's exciting in its own way.
To be able to recite a poem really effectively, first step, memorize the words. Second step, figure out what they mean. Maybe third step, figure out what they mean to you, yeah?
Yes, definitely. And Poetry Out Loud encourages students to pick a poem that resonates with them.
Yeah.
Not one that, you know, they think is going to sound good. And even then, I found that when I listen to these students, the really good ones, I understand the poem better.
Sure.
Because they understand it, and they're allowing me to understand it. And it has to do with their understanding, but also their timing, their tone, their mm-hmm. volume, the pacing, every little detail that they have put into it comes across, and you go, wow, I get that poem.
You know, Vivian, I sometimes think that a poem just in its written form is kind of like a bird in a cage, you know, that you really haven't heard it or experienced it until you've heard it spoken either by the poet or by somebody who really understands it.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And these students understand that too. And they have to read many, many poems before they can choose three. They have to memorize three for this. Yeah. One of them has to be under 25 lines. Mm-hmm. And another one, or it could be the same one, has to be written before the 20th century. So they're in the process of choosing their three poems. They're reading many, many, many poems, trying them on. Do I like that? Do I understand it? How would this be? And so the amount of poetry that's going on in the nation is incredible.
Yeah. You know, I like the idea of their insisting that you pick one from before the 20th century, because now you have to encounter what might be considered archaic or at least outmoded language, right?
Right, right. So how do you, how do you understand, how do you interpret that old language? And they're encouraged to understand each word. You must know the definition of each word. If you don't know it, audience isn't going to know it.
And that goes exactly against the whole thing of being afraid to address students with words they don't understand. It's more like if you don't, you know, like you've got to catch up, right?
Right.
If you don't understand it, look it up, find
mm-hmm,
out.
Mm-hmm. It's very challenging work. It's way beyond mere memorization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, each new word that you learn and each new poem that you learn opens up ideas.
Right. And connects you to another time, another place, mm-hmm. emotions. And so you really find that these students are picking poems that speak to them and kind of everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your description of, you know, getting up in that 2x2 square, I think a lot of people hear that and think, oh, my God, I'd be petrified. But it also made me think that so many really valuable educational experiences involve overcoming being petrified.
Yes, and the students talk about this over and over. They found courage, you know. And one student talked about almost, you know, like not doing it because it was scary. But then you might regret it later, and you find that courage and that bravery to stand up there and do it, and they always feel much more confident about themselves afterwards.
You know, I think if you spend your whole life avoiding things that are scary, you might feel a little cheated toward the end.
Right. This is a case in point. Here I am in this scary situation.
Oh, this isn't scary, is it, Vivian? But you got something out of it when you were going to school, as did I, right? Learning to memorize poems.
Right. I was telling you about having to memorize a poem in seventh grade, and I still remember that experience, and it was good. It was good. Yeah.
Well, it got you able to get up on your hind legs and talk to people, right?
Yeah, right, right.
Pretty useful skill. It's one that people often cite as one of their greatest fears.
Public speaking is a fear many people have. And these students, they're high school, so we have as young as ninth grade mm-hmm. getting up and conquering their fear of public speaking. And, you know, and I have to say that our winner last year the Hawaii champion, went on to the nationals and came in third place.
That's right.
Nick Amador from Punahou School. Third place, and I watched it live, the semifinals and the finals. And it was like, you know, running through the office. He moved on to the next level. It was very exciting.
Great feeling.
And some teachers, I think, have their students watch the finals too because it's live. And it's
provided them with a little motivation, didn't
it? Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming in, Vivian.
You're welcome, Chris.
Vivian Lee is the Arts Program Specialist with the Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts, one of the coordinators of Poetry Out Loud's National Recitation Contest, the Hawaii edition. The event is Sunday, February 12th from 11 to a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu.
Crushing crosswords while everyone else is crushing candy? Is your favorite weekend activity yelling answers at your radio? Well, guess what? Your weekends are about to get a whole lot more fun. Hi, this is Sophia Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, inviting you to join me for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, played in front of a live audience. And now you on HBR One. Tune in to Ask Me Another every Saturday at noon starting February 18th.
Beth Ann, poetry recitation was a big part of my growing up. I suspect it was part of yours as well.
It was, and at home.
Yeah.
My grandmother would whip out a book and just start to spontaneously recite a poem, and those lines are still very much in my head.
But yeah.
These days, a little bit of literary comfort sounds awfully inviting.
Yeah, the first one comes to my mind is Jabberwocky for some reason.
Oh, yeah, that one too.
Was brillig in the slithy toves, right?
Yeah, the time has come. Yeah. Well, the time has come for us to go, so we'll be back with you tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about retaining teachers in Hawaii. We'll talk with the dean of the College of Education, Don Young.
And we'll talk about keeping makahiki traditions alive on Kauai. We like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line with your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can be posted on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Twitter messages at HI Conversation are at BKOZHPR.
That's me. And as you know, the countdown has already begun to February 14th. We'll not only be celebrating our 6th anniversary, but the conversation will be moving to a new time slot at 11 a.m. on HPR 1. If you missed any of the show or want to hear it again, go to our archive on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you in the morning with more of The Conversation.